From Illinois Public Media, it's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're dedicating our entire program to Generation X. Born between 1965 and 1980, this is the smallest of America's post-war generations. We, and I am in that cohort, were outnumbered by roughly 7 million people on each side, the baby boomers who preceded us and the millennials who followed. Being a part of Gen X includes feeling forgotten or overlooked in the news and culture. And it's not just our imaginations.
This 1991 novel by Canadian Douglas Copeland gave a name to a whole cohort born around the same time. Carter.
What are millennials?
No. Matter Bridget? The book is called Generation X.
Gen X is the subject of an exhibit that runs through September at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. We're going to take a tour of that with the curator later in the show. But first, I wanted to talk about what it felt like to grow up as a member of Generation X, and for that, I could think of no better authority on the subject than the writer Chuck Klosterman. Klosterman has written a dozen books, mostly nonfiction, with a few novels as well. He's arguably best known for Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, which was an unexpected hit in the early 2000s. And his latest book is The 90s. It's about the decade of that name. We'll talk about that as well. I spoke with Klosterman earlier this year. Chuck Klosterman, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to begin with this idea of Generation X. When did you first become aware of yourself as like a member of a generation?
Well, you know, one of the somewhat unique things about Generation X is it did not become something that was created retroactively, which is usually how it is with generations. I mean, if you look back to the earliest points of baby boomers, for example, and you know, Time and Newsweek were writing about this generation, but they were using different monikers and it sort of became established over time. Generation X began with this idea, basically, you know, almost with its inception, that people of this demographic and this age are going to sort of be framed in this way. You know, there was an anthology called The Gen X Reader that was out in the very earliest part of the 90s, you know, and like Douglas Copeland was in there and people of that nature. So I think that my sort of understanding that I was kind of part of this group was almost instantaneous with its creation. I would say in college, because I started college in 1990, I was fully aware of this by my sophomore year, that this was sort of how the generation is seen and the characteristics that we allegedly possessed, you know.
You acknowledge in the beginning of the book, I think it's in a footnote, that, you know, some people think this whole idea of generations is worthless, you know, at a societal level. What do you think of that argument?
Well, it's not a bad argument. In some ways, you know, the idea of generations isn't that different than the idea of astrology. You know, this idea that everybody born in June who's a Gemini is somehow similar to, you know, that we kind of understand that there's a certain kind of absurdity in this idea that you know, when you were born somehow dictates your personality. But I also think the argument is strange to say that there is no sort of you know, unifying or shared characteristics from a group of people who live through the same sort of historical experience.
We all lived with fear of nuclear annihilation, and every room was filled with smoke wherever you went when we were young. And I mean, there's a lot of things we had in common, right?
Sure. I mean, but you know, the thing that you bring up is an interesting deal. Okay, like nuclear annihilation. This is often associated with Generation X. That because of the Cold War. That was this was like a hardwired experience. This, you know, this fear of possible apocalypse at any time. Now I have to admit, I never had that fear. To me, even as a very young person, it seemed as though that the ideal of kind of like, you know, of mutually assured destruction was a real deterrent. I'm not saying that everyone was like this, but I remember writing a paper in like, I don't know, fifth or sixth grade, arguing somehow that like my fear was that Syria would get a nuclear weapon. I don't even think I knew where Syria was. It had to have been something I heard in the news. But here again, what I'm pointing out is that this was not something that really applied to me specifically. But yet, I have an understanding of that idea. And that is what we're really talking about when we talk about these caricatures and characteristics of generations. It isn't that it is a perfect portrait of every single person. It's that every person in that demographic understood that this is what is supposed to be the way they view the world. So even if somebody, and there were a lot of people like this, who really pushed back against the idea of the Generation X stereotypes during the 90s, who hated that term, the mere fact that they had an understanding that these stereotypes exist is sort of proof of the reality of the concept, if you understand, you know, what I mean by that. It's like the fact that people were uncomfortable with the designation proves that the designation was there. So,
I mean, that's true of a lot of stereotypes, right? I mean,
well, although here again, this is, you know, I always think something that is easily forgotten. If you go back to, say, the earliest coverage of Generation X, the very first stories. Once again, these are places, you know, during this era, you know, the late 20th century, you'd see them in news magazines and newspapers, you know. The things that they said about young people is strikingly similar to the things that were initially said about millennials. This idea that, you know, they have less interest in anything, you know, commercial or making money. They would rather have experiences as opposed to things. That their fear about the future is maybe based in the way that their parents' relationship worked out. It's not uncommon to sort of see young people and think that, well, what they're experiencing must be new, when in fact it kind of keeps happening over and over again. I mean, the thing is, every new generation seems to be less interested in money than the one that precedes them because they are young and money is less essential. They don't have families. They don't have kids. They don't have a desire to own a house. So, of course, they seem less interested in, you know, sort of kind of capitalistic principles or whatever. But then those things change. They age out of them. So that, you know, that's something that you always need to be aware of when we're talking about these generations, that some of them have less to do with the experiences these people are having and more about the fact that they're just young adults, and that it is possible that young adults over time, you know, are going to have the characteristics that we associate with these generations. Because when we talk about Gen X, when we talk about the 90s, we're always talking about people in their 20s and 30s. You know, nobody ever says, like, well, let's talk about the 90s. What was it like to be elderly in the 90s? That never comes up, you know? Like, we never discuss the idea of the complexity of, like, navigating middle age in 1993. It's always like, what was it like to be into Nirvana in 1993? That's, you know.
No, late period Frank Sinatra does not really come up, I guess, in those conversations. What the idea of being young, I've heard you talk about in another interview how sort of today you hear a lot of young people express displeasure with capitalism. That's where they kind of focus their angst. And the 90s were different, right? You didn't hear as much talk about that. And it was really more focused on commercialism. Is that just two sides of the same coin?
Well, they share some characteristics, but on a kind of a more profound level, they're actually very disconnected. If you ask a young person now, you know, what is the chief problem with the way our society operates, it's very possible that they will say capitalism. If you asked that same question to the same kind of young person in the early 90s or the mid 90s, they would more likely say commercialism. And I think on a surface level, people get like, well, I kind of see how they're making the same point, but it is very different, because the idea when you had a problem with commercialism did suggest that the thing you were talking about did have intrinsic merit. It was the way the thing was being marketed and packaged that was the problem. So if you liked something or were kind of, I don't know, distraught, say, by the way it was trying to be sold to other people, what you are saying is you're cheapening this product. You know, the product has integrity, and you're taking that integrity away, and you're compromising it by making it into a pure commodity. If your issue is with capitalism, though, well, then virtually everything in your existence is part of the problem. Anything you like is part of the problem, because anything that is popular props up capitalism more. It is a little more pessimistic to view capitalism as the problem, as opposed to the way, you know, Generation X people sort of very often had this idea about commercialism, because what they were saying, or what I was saying, or whoever this mythical person was saying, was that you're taking something good and you're just trying to see if you can make money with it, and that's disappointing. Where the thing with capitalism is deeper, is almost like the entire system is the problem. So anything that you want to experience is perpetuating the worst thing about your reality. It's a real, it's more of an existential worry. Whereas the fear of capitalism was more, the fear of commercialism had more to do with the idea that somebody else is screwing this up.
How do you explain that to a young person today? You know, and I think this is tied up with the idea of selling out that you write about in the book. Today, where everybody's a brand, right? Everybody's trying to make, you know, you're encouraged to be a brand in journalism schools today and in other places. How do you even explain that to young people now?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult because you're absolutely right. The idea of presenting yourself as a brand, the way, a pair of shoes is sold, but you're selling your personality in the same way, that's acceptable to the point of almost being accepted. And that also sort of feeds in to the problematic nature of how you might feel about capitalism, because you feel like you're actually sort of contributing to the problem. You know, in the 90s, the idea of calling yourself a brand was just perceived as the most obnoxious, idiotic thing. Like it was almost like, seemed like something that would be in an episode of The Simpsons, that no person would actually do this, you know. It was, you know, you wanted to see yourself as less of a commodity than maybe you inherently were. And that has changed. So like you say, how do you explain this to someone? Well, it's the kind of thing that's very difficult to explain if you did not experience it. I mean, this is always the thing about doing contemporary history. Some things are different just because it was different then. And you say, like, well, that's a real shallow explanation. It kind of is, but there's some reality in that. I mean, once we moved into the 21st century, it became harder and harder to kind of explain to someone why there was such a concern over selling out. I mean, this is a concept that, you know, has existed a long time. You know, people argue Bob Dylan was the first person to sell out by going electric, or, you know, the Who have an album like the Who sell out. You know, it's not like this was something that was invented by the 1990s, but that was the apex. That was the whole idea that almost the entire identity of a band or a filmmaker or a writer could be built around this idea that they will compromise nothing, that they have no interest in anyone buying the thing they're trying to sell, that particularly trying to appeal to people who were unlike you, who had no relationship to you in sort of an anecdotal social sense, that was desperate and pathetic. And even if that was happening, you had to show a degree of shame about it. You know, there were a lot of bands in the 90s who their you know, central ethos was a discomfort with this idea. A band like Fugazi, that's kind of the whole idea, is that they don't sell out. When you move into the 21st century, that begins harder. It's hard to explain that to someone who might say, like, well, why are you putting on a record if you don't want people to buy it? Why would you make a movie if you don't want everyone to see it? And as we get up to the present, it's not just hard to explain. It's almost like an unfathomable concept in the abstract. It's like it makes no sense. And I think that, it sort of forces somebody who lived through the 90s to ask themselves, did it make sense at the time? Like, in some ways, I think the fear of selling out was real psychological damage, like psychologically damaging to Gen X people. Because everything that you know, say, you know, when I was trying to become a writer in the 90s, I was, you know, constantly worried that somehow if this achieved the goal that I was aspiring to do, it would somehow make what I was doing worse. And, you know, it's funny when I promote this book because, you know, you kind of move out of that kind of thinking, you know. But because I was back kind of living psychologically in the 90s, it feels really weird for me to promote this book Because it just immediately transports me back to this idea that someone going on the radio saying like, oh, I hope you like this, you know, it's in stores or whatever, how just that was the most loathsome idea possible, you know?
I wonder if there, you started out as a newspaper journalist. I wonder if there's like an overlap there between the way a lot of reporters, like I hate it when a flack will say, oh, I really enjoyed that interview. I mean, maybe for somebody like yourself, for an author or something, that's different, like with a politician or something.
Well, no, absolutely.
You don't want people to be too happy with what you're doing.
You know, there is, or there was at least, a mentality that was tied to newspaper journalism that was, this story was good if everyone I quoted is somewhat upset by it. If every person involved feels that like that there was a bias against them, that meant you actually went straight down the middle, you know? And if, you know, but now it's very different. Like you will see someone, I've seen this, that like, you know, journalists from the New York Times who will do a story on, you know, Beyonce or Taylor Swift, and then they will go on social media and like show the flowers that Beyonce sent them, or like show the letter of thanks that Taylor Swift sent them. And that, I mean, to me, that just seems antithetical to what I was wanted to do, but that has changed.
All right, let me take a moment to remind listeners, we are speaking with Chuck Klosterman, the author, most recently of The 90s, our entire program today on Generation X. We're going to continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Can I kick it?
Can
I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our entire program today on Generation X. Later on, we'll be taking a tour of an exhibit at the Illinois State Museum called Growing Up X. But first, let's get back to my conversation with the writer Chuck Klosterman. His most recent book is called The 90s. It was originally published last year, and it's now out in paperback. Can we talk a little about discovery of culture? Going through the exhibit at the Illinois State Museum, there's a lot of physical artifacts, right? Music, cassettes. Gen X is said to be the only generation that really maybe bought their music three or four times, right? Probably on record, maybe at the early age, cassette, CD, and then digital MP3s. And now we're all subscribing to Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. How do you discover music today versus how you found it in the 90s, for example?
I think in some ways this process has changed slightly less than it seems on the surface, except for the fact that the speed has been accelerated so much that the entire process feels shifted. You know, you would basically find out about a new record or upcoming movie or a television show people were talking about sort of by running in and anecdotally discussing this with people, hear what they're interested in, go to the record store. The guy who worked there might have ideas. You would read, you know, magazines that covered it. Now all that is happening kind of instantaneously. And as a consequence, it doesn't feel like discovery so much. It feels almost like these things are finding you, that you're just putting yourself sort of into the world and these things are flying at you. And then you're kind of, you know, some are hitting you and some are missing. One thing that is a significant change, maybe I would say the most significant change with music particularly, is that, you know, there was a cost and a scarcity to buying physical media that no longer exists. So, you know, maybe you're a kid and you only have enough money to buy one album in whatever format you're buying it in. So you make a decision and say, you know, you buy The Cure. And that's what you listen to and you like it. Well, it is likely that the next time you have a chance to buy something else, you're going to buy something that's sort of ideologically connected to that. So maybe you get Sisters of Mercy, or maybe, you know, you get Bauhaus or whatever, and then maybe you go to Hot Topic and you buy a t-shirt of it. And pretty soon you're part of this subculture. And in some ways, you were almost sort of unknowingly pulled into that from the limitations of what you actually possessed, you know, and that the little you possessed created a kind of identity that you could sort of use as a foundation to build off from. Now, music is essentially free. Like, you know, you're on Spotify or whatever, you're on Apple Music, and once you pay that monthly cost, which is essentially what maybe one piece of physical media used to cost, you can now kind of sample anything. And I think that that has sort of ended this idea of the like naturally occurring subculture. That now, if you're part of a subculture, you sort of actively joined it. You went out of your way to find this and find other people who are like-minded and all these things. It's like, you know, and the stakes are lower because it's free. I mean, you know, it's like once music became free, people could never go back from that. You can never say, like, now we're going to go back and start paying for things again. It'll never seem right to people.
Yeah, no, I think about my own journey. I mean, that resonates a lot because it was a kid in Boy Scouts who introduced me to Appetite for Destruction from Guns N' Roses. And then my cousin who lived in the Seattle area got me Nevermind by Nirvana for my birthday. I don't know, probably around age 15. And yeah, then I became somebody who was into that, you know, that kind of music. Whereas nowadays, I don't even know how I find music anymore. I'm certainly not spending as much time on it. And I don't know if that's just because I'm old.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, it's part of it for sure. But also the experience you're having with the music is different because that scarcity has been removed. There was a long period of my life, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, where I had 6 cassettes. And I would play those cassettes over and over and over again, to the point where I was, you know, you could either say I was reading things out of that music that were not there, or more optimistically, anything that was there to get, I was getting. Like whatever Ozzy Osbourne put into Bark at the Moon, I was getting all of it, okay? You know, because it's just from repetition, you know? And as a consequence, that relationship to that music was pretty deep. Like, without even my desire for it to be deep. It just sort of worked out that way. When you have a limitless supply of art, it's impossible for it to have the same kind of meaning. You might like art more, but individual pieces of art you won't care about as much because your relationship now is like, instead of a, like where somebody who has 6 cassettes, it's like their relationship to music is like a super deep well. Now for a kid, it's like a super shallow ocean where they can kind of wade into whatever they want.
Something I've been thinking a lot about, we talked to a lot of politicians on this show. I've been talking about generational change in politics. I've seen this argument lately that maybe Gen X is going to miss the presidential role, right? It's just going to pass over them. It'll be all boomers or silent generation, I guess, is what Biden is. And the next one will be a millennial if it's not another boomer. What do you think about that? Do you see Gen X maintaining that sort of, and maybe you don't even agree that this is true, but this sort of the backseat reputation it has in American life?
It seems increasingly likely that there will never be a Gen X president. I mean, if you look at the best candidates, you know, Beto O'Rourke, he got hammered when he ran for the presidency. Andrew Yang is not going to become president. Now, you could argue that in a lot of ways, Obama culturally connects to Gen X, like the things that he is interested in, things about his personality, sort of maybe kind of the cool, detached pragmatism or whatever that those read as Gen X characteristics, but technically he is not. You know, in a sense, you know, if there's never a Gen X president, weirdly it will sort of either, you know, validate or support or prove a lot of the Gen X cliches. Because the thing about the 90s was that was the last time, I mean, this could change again, but I don't know, it was one of the last times in American history where emotional investment in politics and even society in general was sort of seen as optional. Like it was, there was no sense that like, that who you were as a person, what your moral value was tied sort of to your affiliations outside of that. I mean, you know, I I read about Reality Bites, the movie, in this book. And, you know, there's a scene in the film Reality Bites where the character played by Ethan Hawke says, like, you know, I'm under no obligation to change the world, you know, or to make the world a better place, I think is what he actually says. I'm under no obligation to make the world a better place. And to a lot of young people, and to see some older people, that is seen as very troubling. That you know, he would almost be staking his identity on a kind of sort of solipsism that did not require him to sort of see himself as part of a larger world. But at the same time, that is a reflection of a good period in American life. I mean, what are politics supposed to do? They're supposed to give us the ability to sort of live a life where we can kind of think about ourselves, operate in our own way, be an autonomous figure. And the thing about the 90s that we did not recognize while they were happening, we were not really conscious of this, but are very conscious now. And whenever people express nostalgia for this period of time, this is what they're usually talking about. It was a time when you could be a separate entity. That it wasn't a time we had to be aspirant. Expectations had changed. You know, there was no Cold War going on. There was no hot war going on. The economy was good. It was a time when somebody could be like, well, you know, I'm going to figure out how I think about these things. And the rest of the world can operate the way it wants. Just don't demand that I participate. And you know, a younger person hears that, and it's so the opposite of everything they are now told about what their social responsibility is. I can understand why maybe, you know, if there's a 23-year-old person listening to this interview, they're like, seems like he's saying it was great because you didn't have to care. But, you know, in some ways it was great because you didn't have to care.
I like what you said about how the idea that the point of politics is things should be good enough that you can disconnect, right?
You don't really have to care about it. I'm always hesitant to say these things because I feel like I am just reflecting the specific experience that I lived through. I mean, you know, that I was, you know, I start college in 90s, so I'm like 28 when the 90s end, 29 when the 90s end. That was, I'm right in it, right? So I'm a young adult right during that time, and my thinking is shaped by that. I guess, though, the advantage that gives me is an understanding of the time that came before, the time that came after, and sort of the consequences of what that worldview sort of did. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that life in the 90s, to a degree, at least in the United States, seemed a little bit underwhelming. It didn't seem as though you were living through a critical time in history. You know, now whenever there's an election, we are told this is the most important election of your lifetime, even if it's an off-year election. You know, in the 1996 presidential election, voter turnout was 49%. Nobody was saying this is the most important election of the 20th century. And there was a sort of freedom in that. That maybe, you know, I do think to a degree that 90s were the last decade of the 20th century, and in some ways they're the kind of the last decade in the sense that there'll always be 10-year, you know, periods of time, but there were qualities to the 90s just to that period, and I think that that doesn't really exist in the internet age where we kind of live in a perpetual now all the time.
You mentioned that nostalgia for the 90s that people talk about now. I don't know what it was like when you were in school. We used to have, you know, 50s days, 60s days, things like that. And that was in the 80s and 90s. What do you make of the boom for, you know, the fact that there's a Friends end cap at the Barnes & Noble now, right? And that young people are into this TV show that was popular, but I don't feel like it, you know, it certainly didn't define the decade the way Seinfeld has or other things like that.
In some ways, there's kind of a predictability to this pattern. I mean, you know, in the 1970s, you know, people kind of hearken back to the 50s. You get in, you'd see like, oh, Grease on television, you know, and Laverne and Shirley American and Happy Graffiti, Days.
I guess. American, yeah.
Yes. Kind of the idea that in the 50s it was a better time to live. It was a pure time. You move into the 80s, there was a sudden sort of rediscovery of the 60s, you know, the big chill, family ties, specifically this idea that, you know, here was this kind of social revolution that had failed, and what does that mean now? You move into the 90s, there was real interest in the 70s, just the idea of like of Dazed and Confused, for example, or like, you know, that 70s show being on in the 90s, the Led Zeppelin box set coming out and being this massive thing, a movie about the Brady Bunch, all of these things. So it's not surprising that we're kind of in this period where there is interest in the now at the late 90s, I guess. It's always about 20 years back. We're a little beyond that now, but time has shifted in a sense. I think that when you use Friends as an example, you know, so that's the biggest, probably the most popular sitcom of the 90s. I mean, like you say, Seinfeld is more almost generationally defining, but, you know, Friends seems to have a life that just kind of keeps on going. And in a sense, that's a credit to that show in that even though it happens in the 90s, it does sort of exist outside of time. You know, I often think about, you know, so in fall of 1994, Friends premieres, and so does My So-Called Life. My So-Called Life comes on ABC, and Friends is on NBC, and they're basically competing against each other. And My So-Called Life is now, when you see an episode, it's almost like Gen X by the numbers, kind of. It's like everything about it is sort of has this built-in idea of all that, you know, angst and the, you know, Buffalo Tom is in an episode and the way that people are dressed and all these things, you know. And Friends isn't really like that. I mean, Friends made a conscious decision to make the people dress kind of, you know, in a way that wasn't too cool but also not uncool. It's just sort of like you watch an episode of Friends, it's hard to tell when it actually happened. Like, is this 1996 or is this 1999? Because they don't talk a lot about culture, you know. And I think that's now what Friends has done, is has shown that, well, there's always going to be people who are interested in a phase of life. The phase when you're out of college, but you don't yet have a family. So your friends are your family. And that you're figuring out who you are in this world that is no longer sort of dictated by school and sort of, you know, your parental connection and all this. And that will probably always be true. So I think that a show like Friends, because it doesn't have a real generational tie, is better suited to exist to multiple generations, if you get my meaning. It's not a period piece.
Yeah, I do. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, so I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
It's my pleasure, man.
Chuck Klosterman is the author, most recently of The 90s, which came out in paperback earlier this year. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be touring an exhibit at the Illinois State Museum on Generation X. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.
This is the definition of my